Well, good day to you. It's Joel with The King Country dropping in to let you know that our brand new film, Unsung Hero, is in theaters now.
It's Luke here. We've teamed up with the creators of Jesus Revolution to bring you this adventure of a lifetime. It's a powerful, true story about a family uniting, growing in their faith, and facing the impossible together.
In theaters now, unsunghero.movie for more information.
Rated PG. Parental guidance suggested.
I've started adding Organifi's unflavored collagen into my food every single day. It's sourced from four real food ingredients, including pasture-raised cows, wild-caught fish, eggshell membranes, and organic bone broth protein. It helps replenish and rebuild the body's most abundant protein, and you'll enjoy the benefits of healthy skin, hair, and strong nails. You can easily integrate it into your day, as I have, by adding it into your morning coffee or your favorite stew, meal, or dessert, or into one of your other favorite Organifi beverages, such as Glow. Organifi's superfood blends offer plant-based nutrition and high-quality ingredients. Each blend is science-backed to craft the most effective doses, and they are such a great replacement for those sugary snacks you're tempted to reach for in the afternoon or late at night before bed. The best part is that you can experience Organifi's high-quality superfoods without breaking the bank. Head over to www.organifi.com/bestofyou and use code bestofyou for 20% off your entire order. That's www.organifi.com/bestofyou. Hey everyone, I'm Dr. Allison, and I'm so glad you're here to discover what brings out the best of you. This podcast is all about breaking free from painful patterns, mending the past, and discovering our true selves in God. I can't wait to get started as we learn together how to become the best version of who we are with God's help. Hey, everyone, and welcome back to this week's episode of the Best of You podcast. I'm so glad you're here for this really special series called I Shouldn't Feel This Way. And today's guest is one of my favorite Instagram accounts to follow. I've learned so much from him. J.S. Park is a hospital chaplain who writes about grief. And in many ways, the words that he writes on social media and in this brand new book he has coming out have taught me so much about the importance of honoring the process of grief and all the feelings that grief stirs up inside of us. This is an episode that is for anyone who's experienced loss or grief and is struggling to find language for it and can't figure out why you feel so alone in many ways in that experience of grief. And this episode is also for anyone who loves someone who's experiencing grief or going through a significant loss, because sometimes it's hard to know how to show up over the long haul for someone who's grieving a really hard loss. And we want to show up for others, but we don't always know how. So in this episode, we talk a lot about both sides of that. How do you grieve well when you're the person going through grief? But also, how do you show up for others in a helpful way, in a way that doesn't add to the feelings of isolation and pain that often come when we feel like we're grieving alone and when we feel like other people don't understand what we're going through. So this episode has something for everyone. Make sure you take a moment to subscribe to the Best of You podcast wherever you get your podcast so you don't miss any of these powerful episodes in this I Shouldn't Feel This Way series. My guest today, J.S. Park, is a hospital chaplain, author, and online educator. For nearly 10 years, he's been an interfaith chaplain that is designated as a level one trauma center. He is a 6th degree black belt, an ex-atheist, and Korean American. He's the author of The Voices We Carry, Finding Your One True Voice in a World of Clamor and Noise, as well as his brand new book that releases this week called As Long as You Need Permission to Grieve. You can pick up the book anywhere books are sold. It's a powerful dive into the experience of grief from someone who has seen all manner of sickness and pain. June uses stories from his own life experience as well as his many hours in the hospital to unpack the various losses that lead to grief. Loss of loved ones, loss of autonomy, loss of health, and even loss of plans and dreams. And I'm so thrilled to bring you my conversation with J.S. Park.
Thank you, Dr. Allison, for inviting me to your table.
Oh, I'm so thrilled to have you here. We've known each other online. We've done a video thing maybe once or twice.
Yeah.
But we've never met in person. But there is such a comfort in your presence online, June, that I have just loved. And I can feel, just even starting this interview with you, tears welling up in my eyes. And it's because what you do is give us permission to feel what we really feel. This whole series that I've invited you to be a part of is leading up to my own book launch, I Shouldn't Feel This Way, right? We're looking for permission so often to feel what we really feel. And I thought a lot about it with this new book of yours. As I was reading it, I thought a lot about grief. I even thought about the title for this episode because I wanted to call it I Shouldn't Feel This Way About Grief.
Mm-hmm.
And as I was reading your book, I thought to myself, I don't know that we're afraid to feel grief. I think we're longing for permission to feel grief. And I think what we're afraid of is the isolation, is the judgment, is the shame that we might get by feeling alone in our grief. And I was curious what you think about that. You take us through so many stories of your patients, of your own journey through pain, through grief. And I wondered what you thought about that. Are we afraid of our grief, or are we afraid of feeling alone in it, or feeling shamed in it, or feeling judged by other people? I'm curious what you think about that.
Yeah, Dr. Allison, that's a perfect, I think, contrast or way to think about that. Because, you know, when a post I wrote, I don't know, maybe a couple of years ago went viral, I was surprised. And I thought, wow, I wrote something very heavy about death, dying, and loss. And it, I guess maybe the algorithms or people found it, but either way, there were a lot of people engaging with it. And what I recognized is that as much as grief or the topic of grief may be scary and shunned, people do want to talk about it.
Yeah.
People do want to talk about loss, death, and dying and look it in the face. And that's something that maybe came as a surprise, but shouldn't have. So you're absolutely right in that I'm not sure people are so much not wanting to talk about it as wanting the safety and a room and a table in which there is an embrace about, I want to be able to talk about this in an honest way. And I think I've said before that a culture of honesty can only emerge in a culture of grace.
Mm.
Can only be honest if graciousness is in the room. So when we do experience grief, there's probably two levels in which we feel shame. I think shame about how it looks, the expressions of grief. There's sort of almost a social and cultural pressure to move along in grief and to get back in the top shape, back into the hustle and grind and the institutional gears of productivity. So there's something about hurrying us along where you can't keep stopping because the world keeps going, even though our world has stopped in loss.
Yeah.
There's also this other very realistic thing where loss is very scary. When mortality creeps in through the window and suddenly we are faced with our frailty, it's a very hard thing to look into the abyss, this rift that has just opened up in the earth. And that part of it is very difficult to look into. And I think we do still want to talk about it. And how do we find the safety to do that?
Yes, that both and. We fear it and we long for the safety to talk about it. And I do think, June, that is a part of it. Even when I said your work online has been such a comfort to me, you're talking about really heavy things often. You talk about really heavy things in the book. I think every chapter has a content warning, which I had sort of complicated feelings about. I thought, why do we have to warn people? But then I thought, well, no, it can be hard on us, right? To read real stories, hard stories about pain, even though most of us, to some degree or another, right? It's different for every person, but most of us have a story of pain in our lives, right? So it is that weird thing. We're drawn to it. We want to feel those feelings and honor them, but we're also a little bit scared of it. I'm curious, June, how did you relate to grief earlier on in your 20s? How did you start out in that grief journey?
Yeah, I think when I think of how did I experience early on or become familiar with grief, I think about childhood trauma. I think about racist bullying that I experienced. I think about social exclusion due to race. Oh, and I should include also mental health, right? Because I've struggled with depression my whole life. I think those things, I didn't have a name for those early on, even though I experienced them very early. And I'm embarrassed to say, and I guess I should own the embarrassment because I shouldn't be embarrassed about this. I just didn't have the equipment or education to understand this is grief, this is trauma, this is what's happening, and even depression. Looking back in hindsight and retrospect, I'm able to say, hey, when I was 8 years old and I was feeling that, I may have been experiencing grief that early or depression that early or anxiety that early. So it's really important that we name and validate those things. And the embarrassment is, I don't think I had names for those things. So probably my 20s or even early 30s. And so looking back now, I'm like, gosh, I think I've always been intimate with and maybe some sort of strange friends with grief itself, but didn't really get to sit down and name it. It's like, like a workmate where you work together, but you don't know their name for a little while. I'm sure we've all had that kind of funny experience where there are people that you may know on the subway, but you don't really know their name, but you kind of know them because you kind of see them and you're in proximity. It was a little bit like that. And I think that's why the naming part is so important.
I talk a lot about naming and I shouldn't feel this way, right? So we're exactly on the same page here that when you can name something, there's something about that that removes the shame. But this is what's interesting about grief. It actually can launch a process of grief instead of this weird kind of shadowy feeling of what's wrong with me that I carry around, some of these emotions that it seems like other people don't carry. I think that also applies with trauma. What's wrong with me that I respond in these ways? When we find a name for something, I think is what I hear you saying, it doesn't take away the emotions, nor do we want it to, but it does help you maybe align more with the truth of your experience. Is that fair to say?
I think so. And I believe naturally we are meaning-making people.
Yeah.
Which means we need to make meaning and sense out of what's happening. And sometimes that occurs by, you know, confirmation bias and things like that. But we take what seems to be disparate elements or sort of stars in the sky and we make them a constellation. And so naming kind of helps to have a point of reference or a foothold in what we are seeing and what we're experiencing. One thing I've learned recently and that I wish I'd put in the book now that I'm learning it is when we have this grief response, there are things that just emerge and erupt. Mm-hmm. There are things that happen in that moment that we're not quite aware of in our own body, the sounds that we make and the responses that we have. They're sudden, even explosive. And then on this other level, there is a conscious choice that we make when we grieve or when we experience emotion. So here's the emerging, and then here's the conscious choice. And I think this conscious act, this very intentional act of grieving, naming is a part of that, and validating is a part of that. And here we have grief where it seems almost senseless. And I think we need this part of the emerging. When I'm in a room with a family member, when I see the shouting and screaming and sometimes rolling on the floor, even dancing or laughing or singing, just those emotions and expressions that erupt from us, we need those. We need the emerging and not to be judged for those. And then we also need the act of and the ritualization of, as this is happening in my body, I need to be able to honor memory. I need to be able to know how to keep this person close and honor them in a way that doesn't forget them. And at the same time, that there is not an unhealthy, possibly harmful way that I'm moving forward. So there's that conscious, intentional choice of grieving. I recently got a new therapist because my previous one retired. She diagnosed me maybe surprisingly and not with PTSD. And I think there's something about naming that is initially scary or almost feels like, oh, maybe this is a weight or a burden. But then there was another part where I was like, everything you described, I was telling my therapist, because she named all these points and symptoms about why I fit this criteria, you know, like 80 or 90% or something. I said, it's scary to hear that. It has made so much sense of the fog that I've been in. It's like I got this compass now. And I can consciously choose in the emerging expression how I can handle this and what I can do. So it gave me some sort of power back.
Man, I think that's really well put. And I'm thinking of the listener. I think you're saying two really important things there. Again, there's that paradox of it's scary. It's scary to get a diagnosis at times, to name something. And simultaneously, it can be freeing because, okay, this is the path. Now there's a name for it. The path is still a path I have to take, but I can do it. I can figure out what I need to take this path through this. One of the things I notice in the book, June, is you'd really shy away from tying a bow on grief.
Yeah.
And yet, I found it to be very hopeful. Mm-hmm. There's, again, that paradox. You show it. You're such a beautiful writer. You show us that paradox more than you tell us. You show us. And I feel like, I don't know if this was conscious or not, or intentional or not, but you almost very systematically, you're like, no, I am going to showcase the grief. Mm. I'm going to refuse. And I think there's a quote in here, you say, grief I have seen is defiance. You know, it's almost like there's a defiance in, no, I'm going to showcase the grief and the loss. I'm going to give you a few glimmers of the hope, a few glimmers of the miracles. But I feel as I was reading it that there was a very deep sense of fidelity to, no, this needs to be showcased here. And I was just curious about that. My sense is that we are too quick to want to come back to tying the bows on things, to making things okay, making things palatable. And there was a really strong, I'm going to use the word also resistance. Dr. Monique Gadson, who's a fellow therapist, she's a good friend of mine. She uses that word resistance, mm-hmm. that there's an act of resistance in honoring pain. And I sensed that. You used the word defiance, right? Tell me a little bit about that. Am I reading that right through the book?
Yeah. So I think my natural disposition is to be very optimistic and hopeful. To a fault, you know, there's a Korean word, sunjinhae, which kind of translates to naive or gullible, like wide-eyed. And my family calls me that all the time. I believe the best about everyone all the time, and I explain away things, and I want things to be wrapped up with zero tension. And I think in the book I had written, you know, I did that, I think, because I had such a traumatic household growing up, that it's almost like I needed the bow tie.
Yeah.
Yeah, so to be truthful, the first draft of the book that I wrote, my editor said, it's really hard. And she said, I want the hardness to be seen because your work, you're dealing with real stuff and loss. But is there landing that we can put in here? So I kind of questioned, I was like, I don't want to treat this book like my own personal exorcism or, you know, catharsis or therapy session. I don't want to just put hard stuff in there, but it is hard what I do. So I had to really think about the second draft. What can I do to not take away from the sting of the reality of loss and grief, which I deal with all the time? And then I thought, wait, but I'm a hopeful person. I'm optimistic, even though I work in these rooms. And I had to really think about how do I maybe blend or integrate the sorrow and the celebration, the loss, but the strength. And then I thought, well, what do I do in the rooms as a chaplain? What I do is I don't exactly fix the situation. I can't. I don't have answers. I act as a presence. And so the second draft, I thought more about how can this book itself be a chaplain for the reader?
It tracks. I got that from it.
So Dr. Allison, yeah, I'm saying this between writers. This is a bit of a meta commentary on editing and writing. So I'm getting a little bit beyond the question, but
yeah,
but it's kind of the thought process that went through it and the heart process of it, of I want this book to be like a counseling or a chaplaincy for the reader. So then it changed a little bit from here, like the personal hard things that I went through to, hey, here is me, maybe in my own hard stories, being a chaplain for myself and also being a chaplain for the reader. And I think the balance is, and this is for anyone listening, it's, you know, life is hard. There is sorrow. There is difficult loss that can't be wrapped up and resolved and bow-tied. You know, there are situations that will not be 30-minute sitcoms. And that's probably most of our situations. And where do we find in those situations, how do we hold those situations together? How do we make it bearable? How do we make the unbearable bearable? And I think the only way is to bear it together. And that's not original or new, but it's always still true that doing that together, being presence for one another, that's when a little bit of light breaks in.
I love hearing that. Thank you for peeling back the curtain on your process, because that's what I got. I thought to myself, this is actually hopeful, even as you're taking me into the depths of real grief and real pain. I trust you, the writer, the chaplain, right? That you're going to show me the reality and allow me through that to feel permission to honor my own losses. You achieved that. This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. What's the first thing you'd do if you had an extra hour in your day? Would you go for a run, take a nap, read a book, maybe just spend some time hanging out with a friend? A lot of us spend our lives wishing we had more time. The question is, time for what? If time was unlimited, how would you use it? Well, therapy can help you find out what matters to you so you can do more of it. We can't get more time in our day, but we can be intentional about figuring out what matters most. Therapy can help you figure out how to prioritize the people that mean the most to you, the activities that actually make you come alive, and the purposeful things you want to achieve. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist, and you can switch therapists anytime for no additional charge. Learn to make time for what makes you happy with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/bestofyou today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/bestofyou. A recent survey found that 7 in 10 parents get an average of just 3 hours of sleep a night in their baby's first year. Moms, you deserve to have quality sleep, and I know one thing that will help. It's Cozy Earth. You can discover the secret to better sleep with Cozy Earth's luxurious bedding products, and here's an exclusive Mother's Day offer just for our listeners. Use code BESTOFYOU for 35% off at CozyEarth.com. Cozy Earth bedding products are crafted with temperature regulating technology that adapts to your body's needs through all phases of motherhood. And they use only the very best fabrics, materials, and weaves, offering superior softness that invites you to sink into a world of comfort. The best part is Cozy Earth stands by the quality and longevity of their products. Enjoy a 100-night sleep trial and a 10-year warranty on all purchases. They're built to last through the hardest days and the longest nights. Treat yourself to ultimate comfort with Cozy Earth bedding and sleepwear, and prioritize your self-care and sleep health. Head over to CozyEarth.com and use promo code BESTOFYOU for an exclusive 35% off. The luxury she deserves. Cozy Earth. Well, here's an example. I'm going to just share this. As I was reading your book, our family went through something that I was tempted to shame myself for. And I feel a little bit embarrassed to bring it up, but I'm going to, because I think this is what you do. Our beautiful, beloved family pet, who's 11 years old, is getting a biopsy for cancer. And I was devastated by this news. And I'm reading your book, and a part of me is thinking to myself, I cannot feel sad about this when other people are dealing with the kinds of things that you're talking about. And yet in my mind, I literally thought to myself, what would June say? What would June say? June would say, this is a loss. It's okay to feel what you feel, right? You are a chaplain. I love you. Use the word therapriest. Therapriest.
Yeah.
I love that. I love that term. This is a loss. And so you were, to your point, as what you wanted to do, shepherding me through that, even though it was a fraction of what so many of the folks in the book that you write, including your own story, are going through. Even that kind of loss, I could feel that sense of, no, this matters. This matters to God.
Yeah.
This matters to me. This matters to my family. My family has had a lot of grief. I don't talk a lot about it, but my husband was a widower when we met, and my two kids had lost their mom when they met. And so I've had this kind of tangential relationship to the fact that grief, as you say, is something we carry with us.
Yeah.
But I just want to say that to you, June, that it worked. What you did, what you were trying to do to be our chaplain, I felt it in real time as I was reading the book. And I'm so grateful for that. It's not easy to go into those places. There's a cost to you. And you share that. There's a cost to you to be so near to so much loss. But through your gift of doing that, you are freeing so many of us.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Dan. I'm so sorry to hear about, you know, pets are family. They are. You know, my mom recently lost her dog. And gosh, it was very hard for all of us, you know? So thank you for sharing that and for your very kind words. I'm really sorry. That's a hard thing to go through. So just slowing down to say that, to say I'm sorry.
There's an art to what you do as a chaplain, as a therapriest. And I want to ask you about that because there is a cost to it. And one of the things that you talk about in the book is how it has affected your relationship with God, yeah, your faith. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the things that was really in my head. I was like, you know, we go to those Hail Mary prayers we all do. Oh, God, please, please don't take her, whatever it is. Please don't let this happen. And then there are parts of us, if we've lived long enough, we know, you know, sometimes the hard thing happens. A lot of times it does. How have you buoyed yourself through that experience with so many people? How has your faith been impacted?
Yeah. I wish I had an easy, clean answer for this. My quick answer is, depends on the day you ask me, you know, depends on the kind of maybe shift that I've had or the things I've seen that day. Because a lot of times I feel like, what is my faith good for? Or what is God good for? And I know that that's a very harsh and extreme thing to say for, you know, spiritual folks to hear. But really, that's a thing that I think of often when I see the degree of suffering that I see. I've sometimes asked, you know, like, God, I see doctors and nurses and even machines doing something. God, what are you doing? And so it's hard to say that I feel held up some days. Sometimes I feel so let down. And sometimes it feels like the universe is cold and haphazard, chaotic, random, and question mark, you know? So that part of it is hard. And sometimes when I think someone can't suffer anymore, it gets even worse. And I think I'd written in the book something like, God, could you just let up a little? I prayed that prayer. You know, God, could you just take it easy? This person's already been through so much. And then there are other times where I'm like, it's hard to believe. And then sometimes it's just harder not to. Like, I long for and reach for this, you know, cosmic constancy, this perpetual love, someone who will love us and be there with us through it, someone who knows what it is like. And sometimes I enter in these rooms as a maybe a fraction or a glimpse of that sort of presence, you know? And I think that's what I want to believe and that's what I hold on to and that's what holds me, you know? So I think to try to answer your question, my faith is very rocky a lot of days and a lot of moments, and moment by moment, it depends on when you ask. But still, to this day, almost 9 years now of being a chaplain, before I walk into a room, I usually do a quick prayer when I sanitize my hands. I'll ask God, God, what do you want to do through me right now? And I keep my hands open because it's almost like saying, God, I need you in the room with me, you know? And that's kind of where my faith is at these days. I wish I had an easy answer for you, Dr. Allison, but really I just look to what's going to hold me and hold us in this moment.
I see an embodiment, though, in your faith. Again, to go to that defiance or resistance, that showing up, walking into that room to be there for that person, regardless of what your mind or your heart feels, that embodiment is an act of defiance against doubt or against death. I don't know, June, but we can't always explain it. But I see faith in that, of just showing up, regardless of what I think or feel. I'm going to take this step to show up today for this human. There's an embodiment of faith in that that is really profound to me.
Yeah. You know, that's beautiful and that's true. I think that is an act of defiance or faith in itself. That's such a true point. I think I'm going to probably chew on that for today. But I think of, even if we're looking at the story of Christ and the resurrection, that in itself was a kind of defiance, you know, against death. And here is this gap of disconnection or the void of this loss this person is experiencing. And we step in, and that's in some way bringing some sort of life into death. And so when I see the resurrection, when I see life being spoken, when I see presence entering, yeah, I can see, and I'm making a lot of loose connections here, but definitely as you were talking, I was like, gosh, that's true. That is in itself an act of faith, and that's beautiful. And I think I'll probably add that to my little brain tattoo collection.
Yeah, there's something about that embodiment that I think we've lost in sort of our modern theologies of faith that is beyond our ability doing the work that you do. You can't, and I love how you talked about as a kid, you rationalized things to the positive as a way to cope, right? And here you are just walking into things that are beyond understanding. We can't understand these things. We cannot make logical sense of a good God and some of these things that happen in our lives. And yet you're still showing up. And to me, that's where the hope came in that book. Like I was just rude. He's still showing up. Man, he's still showing up against everything. You know, you're still showing up. That to me was a whole sermon.
Yeah. Thank you, Dr. Allison. I've been part of some grief groups now or talking with people after the fact because, you know, usually I'm in the moment of crisis or loss. But when I talk to the bereaved folks who are grieving, one of the hard things that they experience, you know, there's something called secondary loss, which is the cascade of loss effect that happens when someone dies. And so loss of physical comfort, loss of familiarity in the home, even things like loss of income, that loss of security, all of that, that's a sort of cascading domino effect that occurs after someone dies. So one thing I've heard often is when someone has died in my life, my family and friends, they stop talking to me. And I don't know why. And we come up with reasons like, and then usually the reasons as we're talking about them and kind of, you know, formulating the reasons, it almost always lands on, I just don't think they could look at me anymore because it just reminds them too much of that loss. But the one thing that they want is, I just wish that they would come over or just call me or text me. Or maybe they don't know what to say, but that's okay. I just want them to come by. And that's a huge, huge secondary loss that occurs that wasn't really made aware to me until I started, you know, seeing some of these grief groups. So that's a huge thing where I think maybe people are afraid, oh, if I go there, it'll remind me of the loss. Or when I look at this person, they're related. They look like the person who died, you know, things like that. Or it's just scary. But it does take an act of courage and compassion and solidarity. It takes a lot. And at the same time, it's so needed just to check in and check up. And, you know, I think there's something in us maybe that feels like I don't want to bother them. I don't want to be a nuisance. I don't know what to say. But sometimes I feel like that's a little bit of self-insulating rationalization. And I don't want to attribute selfish motives to that, but it can be. It can be that sometimes. And so instead of thinking, oh, I got to protect myself or, oh, I don't want to bother them and look like a certain way by going to them, how do I instead have the courage, just even one text, just even stepping in a little bit? There's that gap there. There's that sudden void of loss. How can I step in? And that does take a lot of courage, and a lot of bereaved are waiting for their family and friends to show up.
Yeah, that's so well said, that our own fear of, even at its best, oh, I just don't know what to say, you know, even at its best, creates that layer of isolation. Again, that feeling of I'm alone, no one gets me. And again, it just boggles my mind reading your book. Every single human walking around the planet has a story of loss to some degree or another. And yet we feel so alone in it. How do we change this? And you are just leading the way in teaching us. Just take that fumbling step. You know, you share, I love, again, you share in the book. Here are some things I said the wrong thing. Even as I was reading, I thought, gosh, just last week, a good friend shared with me a really hard, tragic loss, and I said the wrong thing. And she corrected me. She said, oh, actually, it's this. And so, you know, immediately, oh my gosh, yes. You know, it's messy. It's messy to come alongside folks. You know, it's hard. But I think it's part of what we have to do to change this feeling of such aloneness,
yeah,
which is the real culprit in all of this. As part of my health journey this last 2 years, I've had to overhaul pretty much everything I eat. And one of the things I noticed is I wasn't getting enough electrolytes as a result of that. I'm pretty good about hydrating, but I needed something to help get me more of the electrolytes that I was missing. And that's when I discovered Element. Element is a tasty electrolyte drink mix that contains none of the junk. No sugar, no coloring, no artificial ingredients, no gluten, no fillers, nothing. It's formulated to help anyone with their electrolyte needs and is perfectly suited for anyone on a low-carb or paleo diet or just anyone who wants to prevent and eliminate headaches, muscle cramps, fatigue, sleeplessness, and other common symptoms of electrolyte deficiency. Element is used by everyone from elite athletes to everyday moms and dads who just want to get the electrolyte balance that they need. Right now, Element is offering a free sample pack with any purchase. The Element sample pack includes one packet of every flavor. This is the perfect offer for anyone interested in trying all of our flavors or who wants to introduce a friend to Element. Get yours at drinklmnt.com/bestofyou. This deal is only available through my link. You must go to drinklmnt.com/bestofyou. Element offers no questions asked refunds. Try it totally risk-free. If you don't like it, share it with a salty friend and they will give your money back. No questions asked. You have nothing to lose. June, how would you, for the listener, what words would you give to someone who's listening going, man, I'm in this. Yeah. I'm in this. And I'm feeling this aloneness that you guys are describing. How would you encourage that person? What are things, and I hate to put it on the one who's grieving,
sure,
you know, it's sure. It's not, shouldn't be on them to have to go ask for what they need. And yet sometimes the reality is that people aren't doing what you wish they would do.
Yeah.
So what would you say to the listeners going, yeah, this is my experience. I feel so alone in this.
Yeah. The interaction you just described, I want to highlight that because what a beautiful exchange that was. Maybe just going through it in slow motion, that your friend was grieving, you said something and they said, it's actually not that. And then you course corrected. You know, for one, your friend had the courage and the safety to be honest with you and to say, it's not that. And then you had the humility and self-awareness and the compassion to then say, okay, and then course corrected. You know, sorry, I'm going to change that or take that back, or I'm sorry that I said that. That's a really, really beautiful example and exchange of how we can be open with each other. And I'm starting to think that's happening more and more, where the grieving person, in some ways, like you said, it shouldn't be on them, but they're taking a moment to pause and to say, you know, that's not helpful. Or, hey, what you said, I hear the good intent, but here's how it landed. Yeah, or when you said that, I felt this. Maybe you meant it this way, but actually I felt harmed by that, or that is more of a burden than bearing me up. And those conversations need to happen more and more. And you're right that it shouldn't be on the bereaved. And when I talk with those who are grieving, there are a few who will say, you know, like, no one's reached out to me, no one wants to talk to me. And so it shouldn't be a two-way street. It should be, hey, the person who is hurting, they're the ones who we need to go to. And then I'll also tell them, if you are feeling isolated and alone and lonely, and there are people in your life who have taken many steps back and they won't reach out, they should be the ones reaching out to you. And at the same time, it is okay for you to send a text or an email or call and say, hey, I miss you. Or, hey, I know it's hard to come over and it feels like it's death here, but I need you right now. It's okay to express exactly what you need. And that's the important thing, right? Is to advocate for our own needs. And again, ideally, no grieving person should ever have to take it upon themselves to take the initiative to say, I need this from you. And at the same time, I think our lack of grief literacy or grief language, it's hampered all of us in many, many different ways. All the highways are busted, right? The avenues of communication are all scrambled. So how do we, in a sense, provide the grace and in some ways insight and education into here's what I need. And we all need things differently. A phrase that may be helpful for one person may not be helpful for another person. And I think it's important that as much as it shouldn't be on us, a very light touch and as much as we can exert in the moment of this is exactly what I need from you. And to be able to say that firmly and courageously and then let it hang there. That's really hard. It takes sometimes more energy than we want. But I found that setting those kinds of, maybe you can call them grief boundaries, are incredibly important in communicating, this is what I need from you.
It's so good to both validate it shouldn't have to be this way. And because of the reality that we are lacking in grief literacy, I love that phrase. We don't know how to grieve as a culture. You may have to do this. And then for the folks who are in that role of supporting, and here you are a chaplain, here I am a therapist. And I just want the listener here, I literally made this mistake last week. You know, I mean, it is hard to come alongside people. We don't always get the words right. But to keep showing up, to keep showing up. And that part of the showing up is knowing that that person who's suffering, that person who's grieving may say, that hurt me. That didn't help me. And for us to be strong enough and courageous enough to say, I'm still here. I missed that. I love you. I'm still here. That we aren't so fragile that we can't take that correction of being with someone who is in those raw emotions, right? That's on us. To just keep showing up. It's something, as a culture, I love that you're saying, we need to grow in literacy of, again, because all of us are going through it on some level.
Yeah, you know, so I, as a chaplain, believe it or not, I don't get it right in every room either. You know, as a, you know, as mental health providers or professionals, we're not flawless and infallible, right? We're going to sometimes not get it completely right. And even tell our clients or patients, oh, you know, you know, correct ourselves sometimes. And sometimes that feels like, oh, am I undermining my own authority or something like that? But there's a vulnerability and a humility there, right? And I do remember specifically there was a patient visit where we didn't connect and it was very awkward and I stumbled through it. So I gave some space. Now, here's a tough thing and a pause in that part of the story. The pulling in and pressing back is a very difficult, delicate dance.
Yeah.
That's a hard thing to know. Like when someone is grieving and says, I just need space right now.
Yeah.
Do they need space? And then sometimes there's a like, but is it better if someone is there? That's a hard thing to answer. Sometimes the bereaved doesn't even know what they need about that either. So that in itself is a very tough press and pull back. So with that patient visit, I was thinking about it, that whole shift. And I thought, did I do something wrong? Did I get something wrong? And there's a part of me that wanted to go in there and say, hey, teach me what I need to do for you. But then that would have been helpful either, right?
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. So then I thought, okay, what do I know about this patient in that 5 minutes that it didn't go well? What do I know about them? What do I think would be helpful for them? So I expended the mental, spiritual energy to think, what would be most helpful for this patient to attune to them? I went back and I had some different ideas and it's not like it was easy, but we ended up connecting on a much deeper level. I took another chance. And it's not that I do that with every patient visit. Maybe that some of that was my insecurity. You know, we always have mixed motives and there's human parts of us and, you know, funny flesh parts of us, right? But still, the main motive was I want to attune myself and adjust myself for what this person may need. They didn't kick me out. They didn't say, no, I don't want you. They did want a chaplain visit. So I thought, okay, I'm going to try a second time. So it's one of those things where we can try and try again and to also take caution to and be compassionate towards not asking a bereaved person like, hey, teach me or hey, what, you know, what do you want right now? You know, that can be tough, you know? Yeah. But instead like, hey, I can deliver food to you Tuesday or Thursday night, you know, and here are the three things that I can get. Something where we know the people that we love and the people who have lost, we know them. And if we know them and they're in our family, just to expend that little bit of loving energy to say, okay, what would help them? What would that person need and what wouldn't help them?
I love that. One of the things my husband taught me through his process of grieving his first wife, so I would go to him. He became my tell me what to do with my friend who is, and he said something similar. He said, you know, you can always check in without any need of a reply. Hey, I'm thinking about you. I'm here.
Yeah.
I'm here. If you need me, I'm here. And just keep doing that. And if they don't reply, but there's a way in which you are showing up, you're letting them know, here's a lifeline if you need it, right? But you're not also requiring them to do anything to make you feel like you did a good job of being a good friend,
yeah.
Which is sometimes what it's about. And it's just human and it's okay. But you're really trying not to make it about you. You're really trying to say, listen, I'm here if you need me. I'm going to keep doing this. If you tell me to stop, you know, obviously there are boundaries, but the idea being you're trying to the best of your ability, really let them know I'm here and I'm going to keep making little efforts, mm-hmm. you know, and you don't have to do anything to make me feel good about my efforts.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, like, yeah, because it's one of those things where I'm like, if I went to the patient, I said, hey, I feel so bad about that. You know, it just becomes a burden to them. And
exactly.
Yeah, I'll take that stuff to therapy, you know?
Exactly. Can you make me feel better about the mistake I just made?
Yeah.
Right? It's hard.
Yeah.
It's hard.
I mean, there are times, and this is sort of funny, maybe sort of not, but there are times when like someone will say something and I'll go, hey, that's maybe borderline racist. Or, hey, that was offensive towards me. Let's, you know... And then sometimes they'll do a kind of, and I know, bless their hearts, they'll do a thing for a few hours where it's like a whole guilt spiral.
Yes.
And then I end up comforting them and I'm like, okay. And you know, I'm like, I didn't want it to be this. Do you know what I mean, Dr. Allison?
Oh, I cannot tell you. I've probably been on the other end of that. You know, the spiral of, oh, it's so vulnerable, right? It's such a vulnerable space where you're trying to say, hey, and actually I want that from you. Let's say, you know, you and I are in that conversation. I so want you to be able to say, hey, Allison, that wasn't so great, right? Which takes a lot of core strength and courage for you. And then for me to have enough core strength to take that and go, okay, I've got to now do my own work. It doesn't mean I'm a bad person. It doesn't mean June's never going to want to talk to me again. It doesn't mean June hates my guts and is going to go, right? He just told me something. That's intimacy. There's a vulnerability there, but it requires me to then go, oh, thank you for telling me. I'm so grateful. And then doing my own work to course correct.
Yeah.
But man, it's hard for all of us, right? Our egos get in there, you know, so much of our own shame gets in there. But I love that we're talking about this because I do think this is a big part of what keeps us from each other. You know, whether it's experiences of trauma, whether it's experiences of grief, experiences of racism, right? Experiences, mm-hmm. It's what keeps us so removed from each other as opposed to moving toward each other.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, that's a big thing about the fear of losing our own self-regard or self-image. You know, there's a part of us that likes to think, I believe I am a good and decent person. And that is very true. Our value is intrinsic and inherent. And then when something threatens that image, I mean, you know all this already, Dr. Allison, but when something threatens that image, it can be very disorienting, even nauseating. And it can be like, but wait, you know, I had good intent, you know, and all those kinds of things. And I'm learning that, you know, the impact matters. The impact is important. Yeah. And the things that we say can have an unintended consequences. So how do we hear and differentiate between, well, here was my intent, but this is the way it landed. And I need to hear how this other person, the way it landed with them, you know, step outside myself a little bit and see what will care for them.
Yes. It is not about me in this moment. It's about listening. It's about being with. So there's a steep growth curve in this journey. I am so grateful. And I think that this book, June, is a huge gift and a huge step for all of us to really learning, even as we're reading the book. Like I said, it's very experiential. It's like, oh, this is how to be with someone who is hurting. You're showing us so much more than you're preaching to us.
Yeah.
And it's so effective. I read your book. I'm interviewing Lisa Jo tomorrow.
Oh,
and so
awesome.
I read your books and it was the same thing for her. I was like, ooh, there are parts of this book that are hard, man. She is showing us. She's not telling us. And it forces me, same with you, to deal with my own feelings as they're coming up, right? To do the work in the moment, which is how we actually learn to tolerate the discomfort of those emotions that we feel. And you give us that gift of just inviting us into those rooms with you, inviting us into your own experience. And that lets us, okay, how does this feel? Ooh, this is hard. Or, ooh, I'm tempted to want to rush to a happy ending. Or, ooh, I can't tolerate this. Whatever it is, I would say to the listener, whatever you notice as you're reading June's book, that's okay. You might not want to share that with the person, right, whose story is being told. But the more you read these stories and the more you grow in tolerating the emotional discomfort that surfaces for you, the better friend you're going to be, the better partner you're going to be, the better parent you're going to be. That's what this is about. And you couldn't have given us this gift, June, if you hadn't wrestled with all of that within yourself. So thank you for doing that work and for inviting us into it with you.
Thank you, Dr. Allison. I think if there's one word that I can put it all together in, it's expansiveness. You know, I entered almost 9 years ago as a person with a certain box about what grief and faith should look like. And I've had to expand that box over and over and make more and more room in my heart. And I know there's more room to grow. And I think each of us with our family, our friends, we're all going to experience loss. Inevitably will happen. And I think the important part, the question about compassion is, how can I continue to expand, to hold room and make space for this person? Because grief takes up a lot of space. And so how can I continue to expand and grow for them? And my hope is that the book will give a little bit more expansiveness to the person who reads.
It's beautiful. One last question that I ask all my guests, June, is what is bringing out the best of you right now?
Well, he's almost 6 weeks old now. My son was just born. And I feel like he's already so different than my daughter, even though he's just 6 weeks old. But having two children, wow. People weren't kidding when they said having a second child is like having 10. You know? But he is certainly, I think, gosh, when I just look in his eyes, I just think, here's my son. And I think that's the answer. I just feel like he's the best of me. He is the best of me. My son is. Yeah.
Oh, that's beautiful. That's beautiful. Tell us where people can find you, where they can find your work, your book, and more of all things June.
I'm on all the social media stuff and Instagram and Facebook, Twitter, and I'm on, my book is at aslongasyouneedbook.com.
Great. Yeah, please check it out. You will, whether you're someone who's grieving and has felt alone or whether you're someone who's listening to us going, oh, I want to get better at this, right? Read the book and wrestle with the emotions that come up. It will make you a better friend, a better person, a better contributor to this nation, to this world, right? This is what we all need. Mm-hmm. So thank you. Thank you for giving us your time today.
Yeah. Thank you, Dr. Allison.
Thank you for joining me for this week's episode of The Best of You. It would mean so much if you take a moment to subscribe. You can go to Apple, Spotify, Amazon Music, or wherever you listen to podcasts and click the plus or follow button. That will ensure you don't miss an episode and it helps get the word out to others. While you're there, I'd love it if you leave your 5-star review. I look forward to seeing you back here next Thursday. And remember, as you become the best of who you are, you honor God, you heal others, and you stay true to your God-given self.